Hey, everyone. It's Here and Now producer Chris Bentley.
And Here and Now co-host Scott Tong. Hey, Chris, what have you been up to?
Well, Scott, I've been working on something that I'm excited to tell you and our listeners about. It's a new version of our podcast.
Ooh.
Dropping into the Here and Now feed this month. And I'll be hosting it for the time being.
Oh, I love it. Now, just so you know, everyone, our reporters and co-hosts you know and you love, we'll still bring you the news, analysis, arts, culture, everything the light touches. But our podcast is going to be curated by Chris and his team, and it will deliver our best stories, right?
Yeah, that's right. We're going to rely on the same great journalism and storytelling that our producers and hosts and editors produce every day.
Mm-hmm.
Deep stories that you can't hear anywhere else, as well as some exclusive things that you won't hear on our radio show.
Okay, so if you want to hear everything from our show, go to hereandnow.org.
And for the new podcast, all you have to do is download it from the regular Here and Now feed starting this month.
I'll be there. Chris, thank you.
Thanks, Scott. And thanks, everyone, for listening.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jane Clayson in Boston.
I'm Celeste Headlee in Washington, D.C. It's Here and Now. We're seeing developments in the push to prohibit abortion in several states. Indiana's law banning most abortions takes effect today. In Ohio, a judge blocked that state's abortion ban temporarily. The judge ruled the law is too vague and put it on hold for 2 weeks. In West Virginia, Governor Jim Justice is expected to soon sign the abortion ban that state lawmakers passed this week.
West Virginia's new ban outlaws all abortions, except in cases when the life of the mother is in danger. There are also narrow exceptions for rape and incest in the first 8 weeks of pregnancy for adults and in the first 14 weeks for children, but only after filing a report with the police. The one clinic in West Virginia that provided abortions has stopped those services now. Katie Quinones is executive director of that clinic, the Women's Health Center of West Virginia, and she joins us now. Katie, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with what's happening right now. You've had to make a lot of calls to dozens of patients canceling their scheduled abortions. How has that been?
In short, it's been absolutely horrible and devastating. We had dozens of patients that were on the schedule over the next couple of weeks, right after the state legislature passed the total ban on abortion. I drove straight to the clinic, and me and three other members of our leadership staff had to make these phone calls to patients. Our chief nurse was on the phone with a 16-year-old who started crying as she was being given the information and said, "I don't understand what's happening. Can I please give the phone to my mom so you can explain this to her?" You know, she also had to make a phone call to a 14-year-old who was actually in school when she was receiving that call and asked if she could give us a call back later in the evening after school so that she could talk to us with her mother present so she could understand what was happening. You know, I personally had people breaking down in tears on the phone saying, "I don't know what I'm going to do. How can this be possible?" It really was gut-wrenching.
Your clinic is in Charleston, West Virginia, but you also serve people in Southern Ohio and Eastern Kentucky. What kind of advice are you giving about where people in your area will have to go now for abortion services, how far they will have to travel?
People here in West Virginia, they're having to travel to Pennsylvania, to Maryland, to Virginia, to North Carolina, and sometimes further. They're likely going to have to spend a lot of money in fuel, possibly lodging, and childcare, because we know that the majority of people seeking abortion are already parents themselves.
You've recently been trying to expand your clinic. In fact, the Women's Health Center wanted to buy a parking lot right next door. I want you to tell us what happened.
Yes. So there was a vacant lot. It was being rented by the Kanawha Putnam County West Virginians for Life chapter during 40 Days for Life last year, which is a 40-day long harassment campaign against our clinic and patients. The owner of the property had been trying to sell it for quite some time, and so we determined it would just make sense for us to try to purchase it and perhaps use the property to expand our pregnancy and parenting support services. We offered the asking price to the owner, and he turned down our offer and instead said that he was going to give the West Virginians for Life chapter until the end of 2021 to raise enough money to offer him the asking price. So even though we had money in hand to offer him so that we could expand our services to benefit pregnant people and infants in our community, that was turned down. So now we're surrounded on both sides by both a fake clinic to our left and then a vacant parking lot where these anti-abortion harassers stand and yell at our patients.
Your clinic provides other reproductive services to low-income families. Tell us what other services would be lost if your clinic closes.
You know, we've provided abortion care for nearly 50 years, and while we've been forced to pause this care, we are determined to continue providing the many other essential services that we offer. If we weren't in our community, that means that people could possibly go without annual exams, birth control, breast and cervical cancer screenings, family planning services, and so much more. You know, we predominantly serve people who don't have insurance, people who are earning low wages and wouldn't have the resources to get this essential preventive care anywhere else.
Your parent support programs supply diapers and baby formula and clothes and other things as well.
Yes.
Are there legal steps that you're planning going forward? Might you try to take a case to the state Supreme Court in an effort to overturn this ban in West Virginia?
There's so much that we don't know. We work with the ACLU, and they are still doing the legal analysis of this horrible total ban on abortion. So I don't have an answer for that right now. But what we can say right now is that we have no intention of closing our doors because we're never going to stop fighting for West Virginians' right to access comprehensive reproductive health care. And we remain more committed than ever to providing the care that our community needs.
Katie Quinones is Executive Director of the Women's Health Center of West Virginia. Katie, thank you for being with us today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Governors of Florida and Texas are upping the stakes in their effort to move migrants who are seeking asylum to other states. Buses filled with migrants from Texas arrived today at the U.S. Naval Observatory in Washington, D.C., where Vice President Kamala Harris lives. And yesterday, a plane with 50 migrants arrived unexpectedly at the vacation destination of Martha's Vineyard in Massachusetts. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis took credit for that move and addressed it in a press conference today.
If you have folks that are inclined to think Florida is a good place, our message to them is we are not a sanctuary state, and it's better to be able to go to a sanctuary jurisdiction. And yes, we will help facilitate that transport for you to be able to go to greener pastures.
Eve Zukoff is a reporter for NPR's Cape and Island station WCAI, and she joins us now from Martha's Vineyard. Eve, welcome.
Hi there.
So you arrived last night. Can you tell us what you saw in terms of the state of mind of the people who perhaps were very surprised to end up landing in Massachusetts?
Yeah, well, people had arrived here, the migrants had arrived here on the island at about 3:15 in the afternoon. So by the evening, they were kind of in a holding pattern. There were definitely people who shared stories about the concern and the confusion they were feeling. People asked the local police chief, you know, where are we in the world exactly? And explaining where Martha's Vineyard is didn't exactly clear up all the confusion for a lot of them. But people were also kind of settling in as best they could. There were men playing dominoes, kids drawing on a chalkboard. There was one man who wanted headphones so he could listen to a recording from his mom. You know, people were kind of trying to adapt.
From reports, it looks like the community stepped into action to help. I can't imagine there are a lot of shelters on Martha's Vineyard. That is a vacation spot generally for people who have higher incomes. Where are these migrants staying?
Yeah, you are correct on that completely. These migrants are here at a church. There's one building where the men are sleeping on air mattresses that the community kind of like quickly gathered in a bunch of different places on the floor in that building. And then there's another building where there's women and children and families sleeping. They are doing the best with what they have. But you are absolutely right that there are not many homeless shelters here. And it's a struggle to house the people who are here year round in the winter and are homeless. So 50 new people arriving to this island, it was a stretch for resources.
Although I heard one resident describing it as the same sort of action they take when a hurricane is coming, that the whole community sort of steps into action.
Totally. This is an island. These are people who are adapted to natural disasters, hurricanes. So neighbors have been showing up by the dozens, by the hundreds, 100 people by one count were volunteering yesterday, pitching in everything they could. Today, by today, the woman who runs the homeless shelter told me, please, no more donations. We have too many towels. We have too many everything, that the boxes are becoming a fire hazard that we're storing in the same rooms where people are now sleeping.
We have seen governors in Texas, Arizona, Florida sending migrants to Washington, D.C., to New York City. Any idea why DeSantis picked Martha's Vineyard?
You know, I can tell you that here, the political and the national questions are really not top of mind for folks. It's still a battle to figure out, you know, there's one shower at this homeless shelter for these 50 people. So those are the kinds of questions that we're focused on. But certainly Martha's Vineyard is a progressive stronghold. It is the kind of place that Florida Governor Ron DeSantis has said he would like to send migrants.
Is it possible that people arriving on an airplane, as opposed to a bus, which is how they have often been sent to other places, to a place like Massachusetts, might be in a better position than those who were sent to New York or D.C. or Chicago? Massachusetts politically tends to be more welcoming to migrants, and they are perhaps less overcrowded than some of these other cities.
You know, I think no place is a monolith. But here, certainly to this island, I kind of can't think of a better place to land if you're seeking safe harbor. Again, this is the kind of community where people are just used to helping neighbors, because that's what happens when you live so far out to sea. So I think people here are largely being embraced, but certainly there are hateful attitudes. There's some anger here. Most of it seems to be online so far. There hasn't been any kind of vitriol or violence here at the shelter from outsiders. So things are peaceful.
Eve Zukov is a reporter with NPR's Cape and Islands station WCAI. Thank you so much, Eve.
Thank you.
Virtuoso pianist Long Long is world-renowned for his passionate performances of classical composers like Chopin, Liszt, and Tchaikovsky. But on his new album, Long Long takes on some very different classic melodies. The Disney book features songs from beloved films like Encanto, Frozen, and Cinderella. Here's the first single of the album, Feed the Birds, from Mary Poppins. The Disney book comes out tomorrow. Long Long will be performing with the Los Angeles Philharmonic at the Hollywood Bowl tonight, and he joins us now. Long Long, so good to talk with you again.
Hi, Jane. So happy to talk to you.
Thank you. Well, let's start with Feed the Birds. So beautiful. Walt Disney himself declared this to be his favorite Disney melody. What about this song speaks to you?
Feed the Bird is truly beautiful melody, and we had this wonderful arrangement with my good friend Stephen Hoff. So we made it very romantic style with a bit of Chopin, a bit of Rachmaninoff, kind of the fantasy feeling. And I actually had a great experience of visiting the Disney Castle in the morning back in the spring, and we did a music video there. And it was absolutely to play that during the sunrise in the morning, and with a little bit of the birds in the background.
I can picture it. I can. Why this? Why the Disney book?
So over the years, I'm working very closely with the elementary school kid and high school kid. And very often they ask me to play some of the beautiful melodies from Lion King, from Coco, from Frozen. And I always kind of just play the melody for them, which is fine. They start singing with me. But I always wanted to do something which is in a spectacular way, you know, to really inspire the kid, classical music can be interpreted in this magical way. Mm.
You and I spoke 5 or 6 years ago after your autobiography was published, and I remember right. You told me that for as long as you can remember, you've had a soundtrack playing in your head, etudes and concertos and symphonies. There's one song on this album that reminds me of the visit you told me about to Disneyland in Tokyo when you were just a little boy. And it was the first time you heard a Disney classic.
Yes, I mean, that's the first time I'm hearing It's a Small World, because this song was not featured in any of the animation movies. And it was such an incredible melody. So we made some kind of arrangement on top of this melody.
Let's listen. I know it's been a long road for you to get to this point. I remember the stories you told me of living in Beijing as a child in extreme poverty, living through freezing winters in an apartment without heat, scrounging for food. And piano was an escape, emotionally and financially. What is life like for you now, having attained so much success?
I think it's worth it because that's part of the process. You know, when you want to get to the top for something, you have to really work hard on it. And now when I'm thinking about that part, it does help me to understand life and understand music in a good way.
Let's go back to the Disney book. How would you describe the variety of musical styles in these classics?
So we have all sort of a different style. From the Dumbo piece, this is almost like a Debussy. The reason we choose Disney songs because Disney has this continuity of styles, even though it's all from different stories, from different backgrounds, from different culture. But somehow when Disney touches, everything it has certain style, which is passion, is beautiful feelings, very touching stories, very touching melodies, and very gentle details.
Well, I love the collaborations too. Mm-hmm. Here you are with Andrea Bocelli performing You'll Be in My Heart from Tarzan. The great John Batiste is also on this album. Together you perform It's All Right from Soul. He won the Oscar for composing this score.
He's amazing.
Artists bring to the work, Long Long?
They are really the top artists today. And I just feel so grateful that they are part of this project with me. They really bring another magic touch into this album.
And your wife, Gina Alice, joins you. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so here was really funny. I spoke to Pharrell and I said, Pharrell, would you mind to sing When You Wish Upon the Star with me playing? And he said he would really love to, but he's a little bit scared of this piece. He said everybody knows the song and he would like to do something else. And then because my wife also, she's also a songwriter on the piano and she sings. And I asked her, I said, you know, I would like to invite you for one of the songs. What about When You Wish Upon a Star? And she said, okay, I like to do it. So she's doing it. And we basically made this song dedicated to our son, Winston, and then all the other kids around the world, you know, wishing them a beautiful life.
So yeah. Nice. So nice. Mm. Several of the songs on the album are actually quite humorous. For example, there's We Don't Talk About Bruno from Encanto, which went viral on TikTok last year. Here's a bit of that. You know, I hear you play that song with your spin on it, and I think he's trying to reach people who don't really like classical music. was that the intention?
Yeah, I mean, that's also part of it. I mean, I like to introduce a lot of newcomers to listen to this version, to feel what classical music and what classical pianists can interpreting, you know, in a different way. They are very familiar songs. Mm. And in the same time, I also like to inspire a lot of young people, young musicians who's practicing all the time, Bach, Mozart, Beethoven, and Chopin, to give them some new repertoire to play, you know, to feel. So in a way, it's from both sides, yeah.
I have heard you say that music makes life better. It heals, unites, inspires. It makes us better people. How have you seen that in your work, in your life over 20 years of performing?
I mean, certainly music uplifts my life, and I see music uplifted so many others that are around me. You know, when you have music, you basically find a great friend with you. And the great thing about music is music never leaves you. It's always, always being with you.
Do you have a favorite on the album?
Oh, it's hard. It's really hard to pick a favorite. But if you really want one, I would say the Mary Poppins Fantasy.
All right. We came in on Mary Poppins. We'll go out. That's classical pianist Long Long. His new album is The Disney Book. Long Long, what a pleasure to speak with you again. Thank you.
Thank you, Jane. Thank you, Jane. Looking forward to talk to you again.
The founder of the clothing apparel brand Patagonia has donated the entire company, worth $3 billion, to fight climate change. Yvonne Chouinard has been described as a reluctant billionaire and praised for his different approach to capitalism. For more on this, I'm joined by Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Hi, Ali.
Hi, Celeste.
Okay, so the headlines say Chouinard and his family have donated the whole company to fight climate change. Is that a fair way to describe this? How is this going to work?
Yeah, so it's interesting. They've transferred the ownership of Patagonia, which, as you said, is worth about $3 billion, to two things. One is a trust, and one is a nonprofit organization. The trust is going to be called the Patagonia Purpose Trust. It will own only 2% of the company, but all of the voting stock. And its job is going to be tasked with protecting the company, Patagonia's existing values and independence, which are very tied to sort of social justice and climate justice. The other part of this is the nonprofit, which is going to be called the Holdfast Collective. It's going to own 98% of the company, And all of the non-voting stock. So it'll have no decision-making authority, and it's going to be charged with taking all of the profits that the company, Patagonia, generates that doesn't go back into the company to either expand or, you know, produce new things. It's about $100 million a year, and it's going to be charged with using those funds to combat climate change and protect undeveloped land, not only in the United States, but around the globe. So it's a complicated way of doing it, but basically they're taking their value out of the company and saying it's all going to go toward climate change and climate justice.
So who runs the company?
The company will be run by the current chief executive, a guy named Ryan Gellert. The Chouinard family is going to be involved to a degree. They're going to oversee the leadership of the trust, and they're going to spearhead the philanthropic work of the Holdfast Collective, but they just won't get any profits from it anymore. Now, Patagonia had revenue of about $1 billion a year, you know, 2017 to 2020. So they think it'll be about $100 million a year that'll go toward the causes. So the Chouinard family is involved in the running of the company. They're involved in where the money goes. They just will not get any more money out of it. This is a full donation of their value.
So in the past, every time a billionaire donates a large amount of money to a nonprofit, there are plenty of people, including me, who are fairly cynical about that and assume there must be, you know, attempts to avoid a large tax bill. Is that the case here?
Well, maybe, maybe not. The Chouinards are paying $17.5 million in gift tax on the 2% of their shares that are going to the trust. Normally, a $3 billion gift to someone would result in almost half of that as tax, $1.2 billion in gift tax. So in theory, they are reducing their gift tax liability by about 98%. They're avoiding income tax on capital gains and dividends from Patagonia. But they're also giving away the entire rest of it as well. So it all depends on what you feel about the money going to climate governance, right? If you think that that's a good cause and you think that's a good place for billionaires to give their money, then you'll say, all right, they are saving some money, but they're giving all the rest of it. There are examples of people who do similar things for causes that some people wouldn't think are as noble. And at that point, it starts to look like tax avoidance. That's a hard question to answer.
Ali Velshi is MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Ali, as always, thank you.
My pleasure.
The number of methamphetamine or meth overdoses tripled in the U.S. between 2015 and 2019. Researchers estimate close to 1 million Americans are addicted to the drug. So it's not surprising that doctors are excited about a promising new treatment that's already being called a game changer. One of the doctors using the new treatment as part of a study is Dr. Thomas Roby. He's an emergency doctor at Providence Regional Medical Center in Everett, Washington, one of only four sites using monoclonal antibodies to fight addiction. Yes, those monoclonal antibodies, the ones you've heard about as a COVID treatment. Dr. Roby, welcome to Here and Now.
Well, thank you for having me.
So, in this clinical trial that you're helping to run, patients who come in who are high on meth are being injected with these monoclonal antibodies, which most people now associate with COVID-19 treatment. Tell us exactly what they are.
Well, these antibodies are biological molecules similar to what we use to treat COVID, but instead of being specific for the virus, these are specific for amphetamine molecules. So effectively, these antibodies in the blood can cling to the amphetamine and move it from the brain, where it's active, to the liver and kidney, where the body can get rid of it.
Hmm. So it's an antibody that's very specific to amphetamine. It's like an antidote, almost.
Yeah, actually, it's much more similar to the antidote we use for snake bites. So these antibodies have been designed to bind to the amphetamine molecules, including methamphetamine, so that the effect can be lessened.
And what's interesting is these monoclonal antibodies begin working almost immediately, right, and continue working up to a month. They have a long-lasting impact.
That's true. So this particular study is testing whether the antibodies can help in the emergency setting when folks come in very negatively affected by the meth. And as you mentioned, the half-life is 19 days, which means we have anywhere between 3 and 6 weeks for this treatment to work. But I see the effects in the first several minutes after giving the drug. I'd say within 30 minutes, patients feel effects.
That's remarkable. An impact within 30 minutes. So let me back up a minute. What happens right now when a patient comes in high on meth and there are no monoclonal antibodies? How do you treat them currently?
If they're a danger to themselves or to other folks, we will give some sedating medications to kind of calm them down or chill them out and keep them safe until we can figure out if there's any other medical issues at play or mental health issues at play. But for a lot of folks who come into the emergency department high on meth, there's not a lot we can do. There's not a lot of treatment options, and that is just not very satisfying to docs and other providers who are taking care of these folks. I was skeptical that this would work, but I was very interested in being a part of this because so many of my patients suffer from methamphetamine dependence and the negative effects from meth use.
Doctor, can you describe exactly what you see when you give the monoclonal antibodies? What actually happens within that half hour?
So the folks who were enrolling in this study are suffering from some of the negative effects of methamphetamine use, like paranoia or moderate agitation or hallucinations. And what I see after they get this agent is within half an hour or an hour, they're finally able to rest. They're able to have a conversation about next steps and aren't fixated on something that is not quite sensical. And that's what I'm seeing when we give this agent in the emergency department.
And previously, that would have taken hours, maybe days?
So previously, we would give some of these other agents, like benzodiazepine or an antipsychotic, which would cause the patient to fall asleep and suffer from what we call a meth crash for hours, if not a day, and would be mostly non-communicative for that time. And so we are aiming for something that's going to help folks feel better, but not snow them over and over-sedate them, which is what some of those other agents do when we give them.
So you see the impact within 30 minutes. It continues working for up to a month. Beyond what's happening in the ER, it's important to recognize what happens in the weeks after those antibodies are working, when the patient is not high on meth, right? Talk about the life improvements that you're seeing with this treatment.
So this is a study that is meant to test whether this agent helps in the ER. But we follow them out to 30 days after administration. And when I see these participants come back a month later, it's like night and day. They're coming in with a family member or a friend or a partner who's supporting them. So many have gotten IDs. A few have gotten jobs. Some got housing vouchers and actually were now housed when they were underhoused beforehand. And that's the part of this that's game-changing, as you say. You know, it's one little thing that can maybe help all of the social challenges that these patients are suffering. And that's what I'm seeing from this arm of the study.
Let's talk a little about how the study is being conducted. It's being overseen by a colleague of yours in Arkansas named Dr. Brooks Gentry, who has a grant from the National Institute of Drug Abuse. Initially, he was studying treatments for PCP addiction. Why the switch to meth?
Dr. Gentry and his colleagues were troubled by the rapidly spreading meth crisis back in the late 90s and early 2000s and saw the social impact that this drug was having on our communities. And so I think that's why they switched. And I'm glad they did, because out here in Everett, just about anyone who uses drugs also uses meth.
Doctor, is it true that you cannot get high during the period under which you are being treated with the monoclonal antibodies?
Well, that's one of the things we're trying to test. We know that the monoclonal antibody helps reduce the effect of methamphetamine, both in terms of the high and the negative effects. But what we don't know is if you have the antibodies in your system and you use meth, how much does that change the effect? And the folks in Arkansas have tested this in volunteers previously, and they found that it does block the effect to an extent. But we've never really tested this in folks walking in to the emergency department who are maybe out living on the street and in a less controlled environment.
Right now, about 40 patients will be enrolled in this study around the country. How were sites chosen and why such a small sample when the results seem to be so promising?
So this is an FDA phase 2A trial, which means that we're getting very specific kind of data to guarantee the safety and efficacy of this drug. The effects that I'm seeing are the kind of things that we'd want to monitor in the next phase of the FDA trials. But the differences between the control and the experimental group are so significant that I can't help but be excited about how this is going to unfold.
And some of the things you're seeing are?
I see folks able to make plans. I see folks applying for and even getting housing in that month. I see folks coming back, having followed up on some of their other addictions. It's so heartening to finally have something that might just help people who are ready to give this drug up.
So what happens next, Doctor? We know that with COVID-19 treatments, the FDA granted emergency use authorization when promising results meant people could actually benefit before official authorization. What has to happen before this could become part of the standard of care?
So this treatment does not have an emergency use authorization and is going through the standard approval process. This means that we may have 4 to 6 years before this agent is available in clinics or in the emergency department.
4 to 6 years. That's a long time for people who need this now.
That's a very long time. And this is something that the inventors of this agent have been working on for decades. And I'm really excited that we might have something by the end of this decade that could really transform my patients' lives and hopefully make a dent in this epidemic.
That's Dr. Thomas Roby. He's an emergency physician at Providence Regional Medical Center in Everett, Washington, and he's running a clinical trial on the use of monoclonal antibodies to treat meth addiction. Doctor, thank you for your important work and for sharing it with us today.
Well, it was my pleasure.
Almost 8 million children around the world have lost a parent or primary caregiver to a COVID-related cause between January of 2020 and May of this year. That's according to a new study published in JAMA Pediatrics. That's a staggering, life-changing loss for many young people and for a generation. It's also a big increase from previous estimates. Ritu Chatterjee is an NPR health correspondent and joins us with more details. Ritu, thanks so much for joining us.
Happy to be here, Celeste.
Are there areas around the world that are more affected by these losses?
So the researchers found that the countries that were most affected, where kids are most affected, were in the African continent and also in Southeast Asia. And India suffered the most, with 3.5 million children having lost a parent or caregiver. But if you look at rates of losses, then Peru and Bolivia were the highest, with one in every 50 children affected.
So the effects are not just psychological, although mm-hmm. psychological effects are massive. Often they're economic. In fact, they're intertwined, right? Because as a kid is perhaps raised in poverty, that also has psychological impacts, and this becomes a vicious cycle. Can you give us more context on how losing a parent or primary caregiver actually affects children over the long term?
Absolutely. You're so right. This is the kind of loss that we know has immediate and long-term impacts on the lives of kids. It's also the kind of childhood trauma that can multiply the traumas that a child is exposed to in the near term and the long term. So what do I mean by that? So losing a parent can mean losing the main breadwinner in the family or one of the major breadwinners in the family. So you're talking about economic losses, right? When a parent or primary caregiver dies, which puts a child at risk of economic insecurity, they might lose their homes, they might have to move, they might be exposed to food insecurity. And all of these, by the way, not having a stable home, not having enough to eat, economic insecurity, poverty, and the death of a parent or caregiver, these are all well-documented childhood traumas, or what researchers called adverse childhood experiences. And we know from decades of research that these kinds of traumas put kids at a higher risk of a range of mental health problems, anxiety, depression, PTSD. It increases the likelihood that a child will have trouble at school, might even drop out to help their family economically. And also there's long-term health consequences, including risk of diseases like diabetes, obesity, and all of that. So it could have a lifelong impact, especially if kids are not given the right supports and services shortly after this kind of a loss, because we also know that kids are resilient and can recover with these supports.
But that argues for nations and organizations to step in now.
Absolutely.
And it appears there's a gap in how much assistance countries are offering to families who've lost someone. There's a real difference in what kind of support is being offered in different nations.
Absolutely. Like, take the US, for example, right? The US isn't among the top five, but the US has a significant number of kids affected, more than 250,000 children as of May this year. That's significantly high number. And President Biden did bring up the fact that millions of kids around the world have lost a parental caregiver back in May. But we still don't have any federal policy programs or efforts to even find these kids, track them, know who they are, let alone assisting them. And the little bit of good news we have is there are some countries that are finally waking up and starting to work on addressing the needs of these kids. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, the countries who are sort of gearing up to help these children and these families are African countries like South Africa, Eswatini, Botswana, Kenya. And these are also countries that have been really hard hit by the HIV/AIDS epidemic, which is the other disease that's led to a lot of kids being orphaned and losing parents and caregivers. And so these countries know very well for decades the impact of this kind of trauma. And they also know what interventions work. So, for example, we know, and very good research to show, that when you assist families with cash and you connect them with other supports in the communities, like mental health support, parenting support, social support, we know that it can actually have a massive, massive beneficial impact on reducing all those risks we talked about earlier on kids. And so the World Bank now is looking into, you know, funding countries for programs like this for kids affected by this COVID-19 pandemic.
Ritu Chatterjee is NPR health correspondent. Ritu, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Celeste Headley in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Jane Clayson in Boston. This is Here and Now.